Tonight we are looking at reason number 17. And reason number 17 is sort of an introduction to a lot of additional reasons. Reason number 17, he begins to attack the credibility of the New Testament directly. And so from here on out, we're going to be looking at some specific arguments about the text of the New Testament. And those will prove to be very interesting, I think. But there's a necessary evil to get over in the first place, and that's this one, number 17, which is this reason. The epistles and the gospels were not written by actual witnesses to the events they describe, which is kind of a curious reason. He goes on, here's a little bit of explanation. He says, first century epistles, the epistles being the epistles of Paul, the epistles of Peter, Timothy, or James, Jude, John. It says, the first century epistles do not describe an historical Jesus. Second century Gospels purport to witness historical events, but their putative authors, their so-called authors, would be a way to say that, could not have been alive in the second century when they were written. All right, we'll look at this claim and consider it and see if it has any merit. So he goes on, he says, first century epistles are not aware of Jesus' earthly history. This is a major premise that he's developing here. So when we say first century epistles, he's at least admitting that the epistles are authentic first century material. So the epistles are authentic first century material. But the problem with the epistles is that they never mention a written gospel. Now, of course, they mention the gospel of Jesus Christ, but that's in the general sense of the good news. They never mention the gospel of Matthew, the gospel of Mark, the gospel of Luke, the gospel of John. They never mention in any sense this idea of a document that is a gospel document, okay? So the epistles never mention a gospel, which strongly implies that the gospels did not exist. The epistles virtually never identify this Christ that they're talking about as a historical person. Instead, they speak of him in divine terms. And so he runs down a list here of points along these lines. He says, the epistles do not seem to even be aware of the human history of Jesus, the real human history of Yeshua. Their point of reference, they begin by speaking of Christ as the divine figure, the divine Christ, without reference to the human being, to the real historical person. They don't mention his sayings. They don't report his sayings, his parables, and that sort of thing, which would imply that the epistle writers don't know them. They don't know his sayings. They don't know his teachings. They don't know his parables. They never mention his miracles. They don't tell stories of his miracles. So there's not narrative episodes in them that says, one time the master was, you know, walking along and he saw a blind man. And so you don't find that in the epistles. They do mention the Last Supper, but they don't place it in its historical context of Passover. They do refer to his death and resurrection, which is historical, but not as references to physical events on earth or in history. For example, they never mention the crucifixion at Calvary. They just never mention that it happened at Calvary. And they never mention the empty tomb or rising in Jerusalem, that this happened in a real location. And they seem to know nothing about Jesus' career on earth. Okay, so this is the argument. All right, this is the argument to say, what are we trying to prove here? We're trying to prove the late date of the Gospels. And we're trying to prove that the writers of the epistles have no firsthand knowledge of the historical Yeshua. So we want, Asher Norman wants us to accept that first of all, the Gospels are second century. They were written in the second century, more than 100 years after the events that they purport to describe, so they can't possibly know what they're talking about. And secondly, that the writers of the epistles, Paul, mostly Paul, doesn't actually know anything about the historical Jesus or any of his teachings or anything like that. That's essentially what we're being offered here. If we look back over this list, though, beginning with point number one, I think each one of these premises is troubling and problematic to someone who really knows the epistles. To say that they begin with the divine Christ, well, Paul's, does it begin with the divine Christ? Is the divine Christ to the apostolic writers different than the historical person? Is that a different Christ? Are there two different Christs? No. And to say that Paul never, or the epistle writers never refer to the historical person is not true either, because there's, well, I mean, I didn't actually take the trouble to go and find a bunch of references, but I think you can take my word for it. There's plenty of references to the historical facts of the gospel and the historical person of Yeshua. However, it is an assumption in the epistles. All of that is assumed. All of that, it's assumed knowledge. And so the epistles are not under no obligation to rehearse the facts. They are, that's not their purpose. Anymore, what is an epistle? An epistle is a personal piece of communication. It's a personal letter. Let's say that you were writing an epistle. Let's say that you had a Christian friend who you were writing to about some concerns in their life or something like that. And you wanted to offer some consolation. You also saw that they were acting out of line in a few things, and you wanted to offer a little rebuke. Would you feel that you needed to first start off your epistle by running over the gospel again? Or in any case, do you need to establish the historicity of Jesus Christ and what it is that your shared and common faith is? You're writing to another believer in the first place. Okay, so that's a little troubling. Do not mention his sayings. Is this true? Do the epistles not mention his sayings? I would say there is a paucity, a lack of that in Paul's writings. It does appear that Paul is not, he doesn't have the oral material of the master just ready in his head. He quotes him a few times. The workman is worth his hire, he says. He gives us a saying of the master that's not in the Gospels, which is really nice, because it's oral material for him. So he says, when he says, it is more blessed to give than to receive. Well, that's not in the written Gospels, but it's a saying of Yeshua. It's an oral saying that Paul had. This is not surprising, though, in the Pauline epistles. Because in the Pauline epistles, what do we know about Paul? He was not a disciple. He didn't spend 3 years memorizing this man's words while he was with us. Instead, Paul came in, he says, as one born abnormally. And so, yes, Paul's writing from a different kind of vantage point. But he admits as much. Is it true regarding, say, James, that he doesn't quote the master? No. He rarely quotes him directly, but he does always quote, he brings his teachings and represents them. I have a very good commentary on James that shows how almost every one of James' teachings is a representation of a saying of the master that he kind of builds off of. And it builds it into wisdom literature, into connecting it with other texts and that sort of thing. Very nice commentary.
You know what commentary that is?
Yeah, it's called James by, let me see, maybe I have it on this shelf right here. Yeah, Richard Bauckham. Yeah. Excellent, excellent stuff. But that's just James. How about the epistles of John? The epistles of John seem to be soaked with the sayings of the Master. So that sometimes, like, you can't even tell when you hear it, if is that from John? Is that from the Gospels? Or is that from the epistles? So, it's not true that they don't mention his sayings. That they never mention his miracles. I can't think of an instance where the epistle writers do mention the miracles of the Master. I can't think of a particular miracle that they mention. So maybe that is true. They don't mention his miracles. Is that because the miracles are made up, or is it because they don't mention his miracles? Yeah, it doesn't apply to what they're writing, and the apostles are living out miracles. Do not place the Last Supper in a historical context. That's irrelevant. They reference the death and resurrection, but not as references to physical events on earth or in history. Not true. How would you make that claim that these are not references to the literal death and resurrection of Yeshua of Nazareth in Jerusalem in the year 30 Common Era? How do you get there? That somehow this is some sort of cosmic death and resurrection or something like that. That has no connection to the real thing. So this is pretty weak is what I'm saying. Never mentions a crucifixion at Calvary. And the only way he makes that work is by saying at Calvary. That particular word does not appear in the epistles. Of course, the epistles talk about the crucifixion quite a bit. Never mention empty tomb or rising in Jerusalem. That's not...
1 Corinthians 15.
Yeah, 1 Corinthians 15.
If he didn't rise from the dead, then Paul even talked about that.
Yes. So that's not really fair. The point is that he's saying in Jerusalem. Does 1 Corinthians 15 have the word Jerusalem in it?
No.
I don't think so. And so that's his point.
Maybe they should have consulted him
first. Yeah, perhaps. And they know nothing. It seems that they know nothing about Jesus' recent career on earth. And again, I would attribute that back to Paul. We're reading Paul's writings, and it's true that Paul was not a disciple. He's not reporting that. But again, that's not what he's attempting to do as he writes the epistles. He's not trying to relate that material. So I'm not impressed at all. In fact, I'm irritated, and it feels like a waste of time. But on the other hand, it affords us an opportunity to talk about something that's of great interest to me, and that is the development of the New Testament. Because I think it's important, he does raise a good observation when he says, it looks like the epistle writers did not have a written gospel. Exactly. They didn't. They surely did not have a copy of Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. At that time, let me go back. Let me start, rather than starting here in the New Testament, let me just kind of lay this out for you a little bit. Now, you look around at these books, you know, look at all those books. Like, that's a lot of books. And the Mishnah is over there, that's a lot of books. It looks like sages write a lot of books, doesn't it? But it wasn't like that in the days of the Master. In the days of the Master, Scripture was what you wrote. The Scriptures were written. And so teaching of Torah was oral. Because if you were to write down your teaching, it was a little presumptuous. What's written is written. What's oral is oral. And so you had a concept of written Torah and oral Torah. Now maybe this never occurred to you before, but have you never wondered that Jesus didn't just sit down and write a book?
No. Well, they didn't have the printing press.
Well, yeah, but you could write a book. He could have sat down and wrote a book.
Notes anyway, right?
Needs to be written.
But
yeah, he could have written something down. He could have just maybe a little.
Wasn't the way the teachers of the day taught.
Right. That's not how they taught. That was not their deal. What they did was they raised disciples. And they raised these disciples, and then they taught them orally. And then the disciples' job was to memorize what the teacher said, and then to pass that on to their disciples when they became teachers. And this was called the oral tradition. Now, it came to pass that after the second Jewish revolt, and there was no longer a center of gravity, so to speak, to the Jewish world, so that you had the diaspora just spread out and no real solid authority, that the sages said, this ain't working anymore. We got to write this stuff down. And so Rabbi Judah the Prince wrote, this is in the early 3rd century, Rabbi Judah the Prince finished a process that had been started in the previous generation by taking all these oral traditions of the rabbis and writing them down in a collection, a legal collection he called the Mishnah. Okay? Then the rest of the sages and rabbis of that generation got a copy of his Mishnah and he said, this is great. He wrote down all the oral teachings, the oral law. This is awesome. The oral law is written. But he left a lot of stuff out. And he got a lot of stuff wrong. And they began to argue about it. And their arguments were written down, and that's called the Talmud. And so now we've reached a stage where we have the oral law in written form. The Gospels follow this same pattern. The Gospels, also by a Tana, a teaching sage from the first century, are spoken. They're oral. His disciples memorize those words. It's not in their worldview to write a book, even, to write a gospel. Instead, they teach. They say, when the Master was with us, he always said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. And they would pass on the sayings of the Master. And not just his sayings, but the stories and the miracles. And then there was the time that this happened. And then there was the time that this happened. And so you had all these little oral units. Scholars call them pericopes. These little oral units that would, were floating around the communities. Do you remember the time? It was in Cana. No, it wasn't. It was in Nazareth. It was in Cana, like that. And this was the body of lore that was the gospel in the days of the apostles. It was a living, breathing, collective community memory. There's a early second century Jewish believer by the name of Papias who wrote a 5-volume collection of the oral sayings of the Master, the oral teachings of the Master that had not been recorded in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And it was a midrash. Papias. Papias, perhaps. I like Papias.
Was he a disciple of John the Apostle?
Yes. He's a disciple of John, Papias. And he made it his job to, whenever the apostles, anyone who had been part of the original followers or the original community, he would get all the information he could from them because he was writing this collection. Sadly, later generations of Christians found his collection useless, just bizarre. They found his collection just bizarre, and so we have only fragments from it that some of the church fathers wrote down because they did not copy it and preserve it because it was weird. Well, it was Jewish. It was thoroughly Jewish, and it read like the Midrash Rabbah. It was a totally different kind of literature than the church fathers were prepared to deal with. But anyway, I bring this up to demonstrate that there was this broad mass of oral teaching of the Master. And we see it surfacing here and there, here and there, here and there. It even comes into the Church Fathers. Church Fathers will say this, Yeshua used to teach this. And you're like, what? Where? When? But this was part of the community experience. They have the Gospel of Thomas. If you've ever seen the Gospel of Thomas, it's very interesting. The first inclination everybody wants to do is say, oh, that's just Gnostic rubbish, and throw it away. But it's just a little too close to the synoptics and to sayings in John to just throw it all away. And some of it indicate, but it's too far away to say that it was copied from those sources. Instead, what it betrays is that it's a collection of sayings that were passed, who knows, you know, how accurately, independently of the gospel traditions, into the hands of whoever wrote them down in Thomas. Really interesting stuff. I love that kind of stuff. Anyway, when did the gospels get written down as we have them? It starts with, according to the Church Fathers, it starts with Matthew, who wrote in Hebrew. Matthew wrote in Hebrew, or perhaps Aramaic, because the Church Fathers called Aramaic Hebrew, so it's hard to know. But Matthew wrote in Aramaic, and we don't know what happened to that Matthew. Mark is the first writer in Greek, as far as we know. Mark wrote down the gospel in Greek for the Roman Christians, because the Roman believers... Mark was Peter's disciple, and so the Roman believers said, when Peter was leaving them at some point, they said, please write this down for us so we know the sayings and the teachings of the Master. Peter said, well, I couldn't write a book. And so he had Mark write for him. So Mark is the first gospel in Greek. Mark then becomes a source for two other writers. The writer of our Gospel of Matthew, which is not the same as the Hebrew Matthew, but our Gospel of Matthew and our Gospel of Luke both have a copy of Mark that they're copying from as they write their Gospels. But Matthew and Luke also have another source that they call Q. Yeah, no, we call Q. They didn't call it Q. They called it the other source we have, the other Gospel we have. So, what you'll find is that Matthew and Luke have material Mark doesn't have. But if Mark has material, Matthew and Luke have it, generally.
Say that statement again.
Okay. Matthew and Luke copy from Mark. So they will agree on what they get from Mark. And then Matthew and Luke will agree on what they get from Q, but Mark won't have that. How's that? Okay. So Q is lost. Except for what we could put together and say, well, both Matthew and Luke have this, but Mark doesn't. Then Matthew, of course, has his own material that he's picked up from the community. And Luke really goes to town. As he says in the beginning of his gospel, he says, a lot of people have tried to put together some sort of narrative, some sort of record. So I went and investigated everything thoroughly, and this is what you've got. And so Luke goes and gets a lot of material from... Luke has a long time in the Jerusalem community while Paul is sitting in prison in Caesarea for 2 years. Luke has 2 years in the Jerusalem and Caesarea community to knob around with the original apostles and get material from them. So we find that Luke has things that neither Matthew nor Mark have. But you see the relationship between Matthew, Mark, and Luke, right? That's why they're called synoptic gospels, because they're so closely tied together. Then, John is a completely different animal. John is written in Ephesus. And according to church tradition, John is written by the Apostle John. But I would like to disagree with that, if you'll entertain me for a moment on that theory. I believe John was written by the disciples of John in Ephesus. So John probably compiled by his Jewish and Gentile disciples in the city of Ephesus after John's death. How do we know? Because at the end of John, it says, this is the disciple who saw these things and wrote these things. We know that his testimony is true, and it goes into this second, this first-person plural voice talking about how John is dead now, and what he said is true. So there's your final redactor anyway. Your final hand in the Gospel of John is posthumous, meaning after John's death.
Similarly, Revelation
is different. Most scholars do not believe that Revelation is written by the same John. They think it's written by a different guy named John, which is possible. There was a lot of guys named John. I like to think that it's the same John. Church tradition is really strong that it's the same John.
And so when you're saying the same John, you're saying that group of John's disciples?
No.
John.
Okay. According to church legend, when John left for Ephesus, he was assigned to go there by the 12. They took a map and they said, hey, you know, the master told us to go and we haven't gone, we better go. And so this is like 11 years after or something. And so they cast lots and John got Asia Minor, where Paul had been working. So he gets to go clean up his mess. And so he's sent to Ephesus and he says, I can't go to, I don't speak Greek. And so they say, well, take Prochorus with you. Prochorus is one of the seven deacons. So Prochorus goes with John to Ephesus as his translator. And then John lives in Ephesus and he travels and he goes around to the communities in Asia Minor and he's probably learning Greek while he's doing this. But so Prochorus would be the writer. Just like Paul always had a writer, John would have a writer and a translator. And so that strong Johannine voice that we recognize would probably be the voice of his translator. Whereas the very bad Greek of Revelation, which is thoroughly Semitic, and I don't read Greek, so don't think of me as, I'm just telling you what I've read about it. It's bad Greek. The syntax is bad, and it's a very Semitic form of Greek. That may be John's hand, as near the end of his life, because he receives a command from heaven that says, "Write."